This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering, and we begin in Newton with a dividing line in a debate over a proposed gun store. A major rift has opened up within the gun control community there, where the question is to ban or not to ban. Earlier this month, Newton joined Dedham and Westwood as one of just a few Massachusetts communities with zoning to regulate firearms businesses. Newton's zoning now prevents a gun shop that wanted to open near the heart of one of Newton's villages, and it relegates any future shop proposals to a handful of remote locations in the city. For some gun control advocates, however, that doesn't go far enough, and this evening, the city council holds a hearing on a proposed outright ban of gun sellers. Proponents of the ban say it's time for bold action. Critics, including Newton's city attorney Alyssa Giuliani, warn that a ban, quote, would not withstand, unquote, a legal challenge, and that such a challenge in the courts could actually create case law that might limit communities around the country in their ability to restrict gun sellers. So today we want to talk to voices on both sides of the issue. First, Emily Norton, Newton's city councilor for Ward 2, joins us. Emily, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you, Tiziana. Great to be here.
So, Emily, you support the idea of a ban on gun stores. Why?
So, when we first learned about this gun store being proposed, it was quite a shock, and some residents wondered why we hadn't zoned to limit gun stores at all. But there hasn't been. I grew up in Newton. There hasn't been a gun store in over, I think, about 20 years. And we heard very quickly from residents that they didn't want it near them, including my own son, who's in middle school, and said, "Mom, don't let them open a gun store near us. Someone's going to go and buy a gun and shoot up our school," because the gun store is proposed was right down the street. As you said, it's near a village center, and it's very close to where I live, and it's in the ward that I represent. So
Emily, sorry to interrupt, but that's been zoned away. This is a step further. This is banning. Why all the way to a ban?
Well, so the choice we had, and our law department recommended that we create zoning to actually allow a gun store, but that's not what most people reaching out to me wanted. And there were lawn signs all over the city, if anyone who drove through Newton recently saw them, saying "stop gun stores in Newton." They didn't say "stick gun stores on Rumford Ave, stick gun stores on the street." No one really wants this near them. So I'm not really in favor of a proposal that gets it away from near me or near you, but sticks it over on Rumford Ave and Riverdale Ave. And particularly as right over the line in Waltham, there are some on Rumford Ave, there are two nonprofits that serve children who have experienced trauma, children and grownups who have experienced brain injury. And so all we're doing is saying this part of the city is appropriate to have a gun store. And okay, I don't fundamentally agree with that.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, but we have limited time and I have a number of questions I want to ask. I know that more than 1,000 people have signed on to a petition supporting gun sellers in Newton. We also know that some gun control advocates think a ban is too far. So what about their interests in this conversation?
So the argument, and I know that you have someone who's going to talk about this, but the argument against the ban is that, oh, it's going to put us at legal risk. But, you know, anyone can sue us at any time. Cambridge has had a ban on the books since 1986. The gun manufacturing industry is not looking for a test case. There's test cases if they want it. I think in this case, we should be doing what we actually think is right and saying we have an epidemic of gun violence. We do not need to make it even easier to access guns. We need to make it harder, arguably. And there's gun shops right over the line in Waltham now. We don't need a gun store in Newton for people to be able to buy guns. There's a Second Amendment right to bear arms. There is not a Second Amendment right to sell arms.
Okay, so in an email to Newton Mayor Ruth Ann Fuller and members of the Newton City Council, the Giffords Law Center, public interest law center led by former Congresswoman Gabrielle Giffords, said they don't recommend pursuing a ban on gun shops. And they're talking about at this time versus, let's say, 86 with Cambridge. They've said, quote, "in light of the fact that former President Trump filled the federal judiciary, including the Supreme Court, with gun extremists, even a law fully consistent with existing constitutional precedent could face a serious threat," unquote. And my understanding is the concern is this could be a Pyrrhic victory because it could create case law against the ban that would actually make it harder for communities around the country to restrict gun shops. What is your answer to that concern?
Yeah, I appreciate that argument. And I've had conversations with folks who have that point of view. I've also been in touch with John Rosenthal, who people may remember had the billboards along the Mass Pike. Let's just say there are differing opinions among folks who are experts, the Constitution. And we've had literally Mintz Levin and Foley Hoag, two pretty prominent law firms in Boston, have stepped up to represent Newton pro bono in the case of a challenge.
So you actually are okay if this goes to the courts. What about costs and things being tied up in the courts, even if you might eventually win?
It's not that I'm thrilled at the idea of litigation, but I don't think we've protected ourselves now. It was very clear in our debates on the city council that even the folks who were supporting the zoning were doing it because they thought that this would limit a gun store from opening. So if someone wants to sue us, they can sue us. The person who was trying to open the store at 709 Washington Street that we've just zoned away, that person could sue us if they want. This is America. You can sue someone if you want. I don't think that we have actually protected ourselves in the way that people argue that we can. And I just want to tell your listeners, a few years ago when Newton was considering passing a welcoming city ordinance, there were folks who said, oh, don't do that. You know, President Trump will take away $12 million because it'll be considered a quote unquote sanctuary city. We went ahead with it anyway. I think Newton is a community that really lives its values, and you don't want to be stupid about it. But like I said, I don't really think we're at any more risk of a ban versus a zoning limitation that looks like a ban.
Okay, so last question. Gun ownership is a constitutional right, strongly affirmed by the U.S. Supreme Court. What about just the pushback that a ban on gun shops interferes with Second Amendment rights?
You can buy a gun right over the line in Waltham. You are not limited in Massachusetts from being able to access guns now. I just don't think we need to make it easier and open yet another one here in Newton.
All right, Newton City Councilor Emily Norton. Thanks, Emily, for giving us your time. So now we turn to Laura Tovim, co-founder of the Newton Gun Violence Prevention Cooperative. Laura, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you for having me.
So Laura, you helped drive the process of creating the zoning we just talked about in Newton. I know you heard City Councilor Emily Norton. Just a couple of sentences of reaction to what you just heard.
Yeah, I mean, I think I do agree with Councilor Norton that there are no acceptable locations in Newton for a gun shop. But I am opposed to a ban, not because I'm opposed to a ban in general, but I'm opposed to it in this judicial climate. We have a very strong zoning ordinance in place that will accomplish our goals. And enacting a ban right now is just simply reckless.
So Emily says, but it's the time to push. And there are law firms that are prepared to defend the city. And even you, I think, just stipulated that the ultimate goal, as I understand it from you, is no gun shop in Newton. So why not go the extra step and ban them outright? That is really the intent, right?
Well, I think that the zoning ordinance that we have in place was very carefully constructed. It was constructed with the advice of the Giffords Law Center, which, as you know, is one of the country's leading forces in gun violence prevention and in fighting the gun lobby. And what the city did was look at other municipalities that had tried to address this issue, and they learned that the best way to do this is through zoning. So the city mapped out a lot of different scenarios for how we could do this and how we could minimize locations for gun stores while still being legally defensible. So I think that's really important. I know Emily Norton said that we could be sued no matter what, and that is absolutely true. But the zoning ordinance we have in place minimizes the risk of us losing a court battle, whereas in a complete
ban... But it does also leave room for a gun store to then actually be located in the community, right?
So just to be clear, there are no gun stores attempting to open in Newton. No one's putting a gun store anywhere, not in Rumford, not on the street, not on North Street. There's no one trying to open in those locations. But the...
I'm so sorry to interrupt you just to clarify, because you said no gun stores are trying to open in Newton. But as I understand it, right, the thing that started this whole conversation was a gun store trying to open on Washington Street. So this is just me clarifying what you just said.
That is correct. That is correct. A gun store tried to open on Washington Street, and the ordinance was put in place to stop that. But the ordinance is not just buffer zones. There are many protections in the ordinance that make Newton very inhospitable to gun stores. There are pages of regulations and rules. So Newton is not a place that is a welcoming place for gun stores. And importantly, it requires a special permit. And as part of the special permitting process, counselors are allowed to weigh whether they think whether a gun store would be beneficial to the neighborhood where it's proposed. The special permit process also requires a public hearing so that people can come forward and say why certain locations are not beneficial to the city. And as Emily would let you know, we had over 500 people at a public hearing about the zoning ordinance. People care deeply about this. And I'm one of the people who heard about this store before the city council. And I will tell you that it was not about any specific location. If a gun store tries to open in Newton, despite all the barriers we have put in place, there are thousands of residents who are ready to speak up and fight against it.
And so I'm gonna stop you there again, just because of time. I have a lot of things I need to ask you. I'm gonna ask you the same question I asked Emily. Then, more than 1,000 people signed a petition saying they want the ability to buy a firearm in Massachusetts, and there is a Second Amendment right to bear arms. Are you providing due consideration to those in the community who believe there should be a right to purchase a firearm in the city of Newton?
I mean, I think that most Newton residents have been very clear that this is not a place where we want a gun store. And I think that, like Emily said, there are plenty of places to buy guns near Newton. So I think that the city council has a duty to enact the will of its people.
Do you see a way to find common ground within the gun control community that is split here without creating the possibility of serious legal risk for your agenda?
Well, I think what's really important here is to look beyond Newton and look at the impact that a ban could have on the rest of the country. I think that I'm someone who's been doing gun violence prevention for many years, and it's not a simple, easy problem to tackle. I would really love it if the city councilors could redirect their energy to really putting in the difficult work that we need that will actually make us safer rather than making people feel a little better. So I think city councilors really would do great to start explaining the complex ordinance for them to their constituents and explaining how it's going to work. And then I think we really need to slow down and explore the ways the cities can address some of the root causes of gun violence in Newton, and also support the strategic and well thought out strategic initiatives that the state level gun violence prevention folks are moving forward.
All right. Laura Tovim, local gun control advocate and co-founder of the Newton Gun Violence Prevention Cooperative. Laura, thanks for joining us as well.
Thank you so much.
School is out for the summer for many kids, and if not, it will be soon, and that means camp is in session. But after a year of masks, Zoom school, quarantining, this summer seems like it has special meaning for campers and their families as kids venture out, many for the first time. So how do you let kids be kids while also supporting them after, you know, a tumultuous year? We want you to join the conversation. Are your kids heading to camp this summer? Are they in camp right now? What are you most excited or concerned about? Is camp beyond your financial reach this summer? And if so, what resources do you need to help your kids transition back into being kids? 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK to join the conversation. Joining us now, Michelle Rocliffe, the president of American Camp Association New England, which accredits hundreds of day and sleepaway camps in the region. And coming back to the show, Nick Teich, CEO and founder of Harbor Camps, which operates a handful of programs, including Camp, I always have trouble with this, Aeronautic for transgender and non-binary youth. Michelle, Nick, thanks for both being here.
Thanks for having us.
Yes, thank you. Excited to be here.
And Nick, did I get it right? Aeronautic, right?
You did.
Yay! There we go. Okay, so Michelle, I'm actually going to start with you. Camps are open this year. We want to get to that. But let's just put this in context. Remind us, how did the pandemic impact the summer and day camp industry in Massachusetts and in the area last year?
Oh, my goodness, do we have to remind everybody? No, I hear you, and thanks for the question. You know, the summer of 2020 was really devastating to our industry in 2020, let alone to all the children and all the families who weren't able to have that experience. in the state of Massachusetts, overnight camp, sleepaway camp was not even allowed to operate at all. And less than 50% of our day camps opened. And those day camps that opened really opened with a lower capacity. So with the country coming to grips with COVID and our numbers being so low right now and so much work being put into the planning the last 8, 9, 10 months, we are so excited for 2021 and to be able to let kids be kids, go outside, have fun, enjoy what they should be enjoying in the summer, and really prepare for hopefully going back to school in the fall.
Nick, what does it take to ramp up to open? And is that harder if a camp has been closed for longer?
Well, we've been working on this for the past 15 months or so. So it's been a huge challenge. But I think that, you know, I don't know if it's easier or harder for people who were able to run last year versus people who didn't, like us. But it's been an incredible amount of work. I've learned a lot, most of which I hope to forget after this summer. But it's been a lot of work, and it's not for the faint of heart to go through this and plan this and be able to think that, you know, to hope that you can pull it off. And we certainly, you know, think we can. So it's been very difficult, been in a lot of meetings, gotten closer with a lot of camp director friends, which has been the upside of it. And a lot of us feel like we're all in this together. So we're ready.
I'm going to put the number back out. 1-800-423-8255. Are your kids going back to camp this summer, and what will it mean for them? We'll go to calls in just a second, but a couple more quick questions to the two of you first. Michelle, my understanding is that in the region, there were some camps that opened last summer, and those have actually become models for what to do now. Is that right?
Yes, we were very fortunate that in the New England region, there were camps that opened successfully and safely in 2020. There were a handful of camps in Maine who did this and who really became the models for great practices moving forward, sharing their learnings with the CDC and the EH&E on how to do this safely. What they did is really they layered their approach of non-pharmaceutical interventions, NPIs they called it, and it's everything that we've been hearing: social distancing, cohorting, masking, cleaning, not letting visitors onto camp. So the more you layer these practices, the safer it can be. And, you know, there were some stories in the media around the country of not so wonderful camp experiences. And really, those camps didn't take the effort to layer all these different approaches. So as Nick mentioned, planning for 15 months, there were so many camps sharing what they did to be successful. And as guidelines have changed over the months, what we're seeing is camps, you know, had plan A, plan B, plan C, plan D, and then they've adjusted as they came, as the guidelines have changed. But we did have some very successful camp openings in 2020.
So let me turn to you, Nick, briefly, and then I'll go to calls. Nick, what of those practices will be in place for your camps?
Most of what Michelle had mentioned. I mean, we are following the American Camp Association field guide, as well as New Hampshire regulations, as well as CDC guidance, and sort of, you know, all of the things right in there. So we are doing cohorting. You know, we are ramping up cleaning. We are doing stuff outside. We're layering the approaches of the NPIs. And as well, we have been pleasantly surprised by the amount of campers 12 and up who have gotten fully vaccinated already, which means they actually had to jump right on it when it became available. And in some ways, that's going to make things a little bit easier for those cabins and those kids, which is wonderful. You know, we wish that all the kids could have been vaccinated, but we cannot complain given the speed at which things are moving. So, you know, it's a lot to juggle and balance, but we're following all of the things Michelle mentioned.
1-800-423-8255. 855 to join this conversation about summer camps, the importance of them this summer, whether your kids are going, if they can't go, what's lost by not having that experience. We've got Beth on the line in Framingham. Beth, go ahead.
Yes, hi. So this is going to be the second pandemic summer that my kids are going to camp. They went last summer to a Y camp, and they're going again this year. My 17-year-old just started today. She's a counselor for her second summer, and my 9-year-old will be starting next week as a camper, and it is just such a relief both last summer and this summer. It's just allowing them to be kids, really, and get off of screens, and they're both so excited, and we're thrilled that they're able to do this. We're just so grateful.
And Beth, day camp or overnight camp, just so we know?
Day camp for the Y camp, and then later on in the summer, my son will be going to a week of sleepaway camp.
Thanks for that call, Beth. I want to add one more caller here. We've got Bob on the line from Southend. Bob, go ahead.
Hi, Tiziana. Thanks for taking my call. I'm actually a child therapist. I happen to also be on the board of a number of children's summer camps, including Nick Teich's, by the way, and on the board of a camp called Boston Explorers, which is an urban day camp for kids. And I have to tell you, from the point of view of a child therapist, kids just have been suffering. I mean, they've been, I think one of the things this pandemic has made us all realize are the limits of screens and the limits of social media. Kids have missed each other. I think they've missed just that freedom of play. And I kind of have to say, when I hear people talk about summer learning loss and we should put kids into summer school, they don't understand children. Children need to be with friends. They need to run around. They need to have exercise. They need to have a sense of autonomy that comes from camp. And then they will be in the mindset to go back to school. I wish every single kid in the country could go to camp and run through sprinklers and just, you know, have fun and eat ice cream and be with their friends. That's what they need.
Bob, thank you for that call. So Nick, with Bob having serving on your board, I'll turn back to you. Are you expecting different social emotional needs from kids this summer than in the past? I mean, you support vulnerable kids in your camps as it is.
Yes, we are. And actually, we've been very closely in touch with Bob throughout the year, and he's given us invaluable information about this and how the social and emotional health of kids and staff, by the way, is going to change. People are going to have to get used to socializing again. And for some kids, it's going to be the most amazing thing and they're not going to miss a beat. And for other kids, they're going to be very slow to warm up and a little bit, I think, just pausing and saying, is this okay? It was just, you know, out of school for a year and a half or a year. And is this okay to do this? And it makes me think about, you know, my anxiety or my depression or whatever they're dealing with. And you're right. I mean, our kids being transgender and non-binary, and we have a couple of other camps as well, all deal with that already. So it's compounded. So we are prepared to be dealing with perhaps some more social and emotional issues. However, I'm hopeful that a lot of the campers and staff will be so thrilled to be around one another that the support will lift them up and over that. So that's sort of the best way that I'm looking at it.
And Michelle, in general, in camp networks, you know, do camps, I'm assuming the majority of camps are nonprofit. That may be a bad assumption, and you can correct me if it is. But do camps have the resources to be prepared for the mental health needs, the social emotional needs the kids may be coming to camp with this summer that they haven't in the past because they've never come to camp after a global pandemic?
I think it's a topic that the camp industry and camp colleagues started talking about really last fall. Folks knew that this was and could be an issue in 2021. So a lot of our conferences, our webinars, our coffee and chats was really focused on the social emotional health of children. So from what I'm seeing, whether it's for-profit or non-for-profit camps, they are putting the time, energy, money, resources behind the training to learn more about this. We're excited, you know, to be able to be, you know, the industry that's kind of the first to get these kids back and experience this. you know, whether it's their social emotional health or just even group work, like learning to work with kids in a group again, it's just such a different time. But 100% it is a focus of what camps have been talking about, as Nick said, like the last even 15 months, we knew this was going to be here.
And one more question to you before I go back to Nick. Nick mentioned being pleased with the rate of vaccination for kids 12 and older. What about kids 12 and younger, or excuse me, younger than 12, who can't yet get vaccinated? What are the preparations? Are there different concerns there? How are camps thinking about that?
Yeah, it's a hard to answer it with one answer. You know, each state has their own set of guidelines. They supersede kind of the CDC and what their recommendations are. Each camp serves their own population. You know, they might have children with medical needs or medical backgrounds. So the protocols that are in place at each camp may vary. What we're hearing is, you know, some camps are going to mask indoors, not mask outdoors. Some camps are going to mask all the time because they found that there might be inequities in terms of folks being able to receive the vaccine. We know that our kids under 12 can't be vaccinated. Some camp operators I talked to said, you know what, even though our staff are vaccinated, at times we're going to have staff wear masks to role model for the kids who have to. So it's going to vary camp to camp. You know, we really encourage families to talk to camp directors and really understand what their protocols are in place for 2021.
1-800-423-8255 is the number. Is there a memory from your childhood at camp that you want your kids to have this summer, this first summer after what in our lifetimes is an unprecedented year of lockdown? Again, that number, 1-800-423-8255. Nick, we're hearing so much about the benefits of what summer camp can do for a kid under any circumstances, but potentially, especially this year where there seems to be a real push to let kids be kids, even as we are concerned about things like learning loss and having been behind in school. There are a lot of kids who can't go to camp. How do we think about opportunities for those kids? And are there resources out there for families who can't afford camps? I guess I'll ask you first, Nick, and then also Michelle. You know, really thinking about families for whom this may not be an option without help.
Yeah, that has always been very important to us. We are a nonprofit camp and we raise a lot of money for scholarships and financial aid every year. And this year's is no different. We are giving away more this year than we ever have. And we also have more campers than we ever have. So it's interesting. And it is something that we certainly never want to be a barrier for a child, especially who is in our population, who's transgender or non-binary, to be able to come to camp. It's huge for so many reasons. And so I think it's very, very important to have those resources. And I know there are lots of different foundations. I know ACA has different ways of getting scholarships to kids. There's lots of different great organizations out there. But for our camp, we specifically, you know, raise money for that because it's so important. We do not want a kid who's a transgender kid from one background to not be able to come just, you know, as a transgender kid from another background is able to. You know, that's just not fair, you know, in our eyes. So it's really, really important. And as everyone has stated this year, more than ever, to be together, to be with people like you, to have fun, to let loose, to be a kid, to get some of that back, because it's been scary for kids.
Michelle, what can you add to that in terms of that general question about the cost of camp? It can be very expensive. And we know between 2015 and now those prices have increased. The particular need this year and the fact that many families are hurting.
Yeah, I think Nick nailed it. We have camps, you know, on a spectrum in terms of cost. You know, there are all different kinds of costs. What I am hearing is that camps who fundraise for scholarship really had successful annual scholarship campaigns. Donors could really resonate with the idea of getting kids to camp. So I am hearing, similar to what Nick said, that camps are giving out more scholarship dollars than ever. I'd encourage families to call camps ask if there are payment plans, you know, different kinds of creative ideas to get that cost down or to be able to budget differently. I do know that everybody feels that they want the most amount of kids to be able to experience camps. I even know camps that were 4-week camps that are going down to 2-week camps so that more kids can have that experience. So I would just tell families to really reach out to camps and ask the questions and develop a relationship with camp owners and camp directors.
Nick, I want to come back to you. Camp Aeronautic is for transgender and non-binary youth. We've talked about that. We are in a time where nationally we have seen a dramatic increase in laws and rhetoric targeting transgender and non-binary members of our communities. Are you expecting added needs and added trauma for kids coming to the camp beyond the pandemic, given the national climate?
Yes, we are. We're expecting kids to, be coming in because they're exposed to the news all the time, and they come to camp. Most camps, they come to our camp without any electronics and no phones, and which is wonderful in a lot of ways, you know. But it takes getting used to, and they will come in, you know, just having seen all of this with sports and with healthcare laws and things that are, like you said, a lot of anti-trans rhetoric, and particularly with kids. So depending on where they live, they may be more affected than others. And it is really important to be in a space where we can discuss that and we can give them optimism and give them role models. A lot of our counselors, our staff, are trans and non-binary, myself included, and we need to show the kids that we can be strong and we can get through this, and we've been here before, and we're not going to let people who just have hate or discrimination win over. They may win small battles, but they're not going to win ultimately. This is the way the tide is turning, and these kids are going to be okay. And that's a big part of what we do through play, just camp, you know, having our meals together, having campfires, going canoeing, and discussing politics while we're walking from activity to activity. So it's a really unique experience. And it is, I think, so important for these kids to get the message that they're going to be okay. It might not be easy, but, you know, they're going to be okay in the end.
So let's end on some joy. And Michelle, I'll start with you. A favorite memory from camp that you want to pass on. What does camp mean to you? Just briefly.
Oh, yeah, brief is tough. I was a camp operator, director for close to 25 years. I think the end of the day campfire, when the whole camp is coming together, especially at the end of that session after those bonds have been formed. I mean, when I close my eyes, those are the memories that really are just so, so deep ingrained in my memory. And I can't wait for kids to experience that again this summer.
And Nick, how about you?
I would have to agree. And I think as a camper, I used to go to camp for 8 weeks at a time. And I remember sort of talking in the cabin late at night with friends, and just the deep friendships I made that I'm still friends with people today. And the relationships that you can form and really come to understand and lean on one another, you know, just those moments where that happens. And those are some of my fondest memories.
All right. Nick Teich, CEO and founder of Harbor Camps, which operates a handful of programs, including Camp Aeronautic for transgender and non-binary youth, and Michelle Rowcliffe, president of American Camp Association New England, which accredits hundreds of day and sleepaway camps in the region. Thanks to both of you for being here, and good luck with camp this summer.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Listeners, we're taking a break, but we'll be back. This is Radio Boston. Throughout the pandemic, we have tried to check in with members of our communities periodically to see how they've navigated these, you know, unprecedented times. Last year, the Monday after Father's Day, we talked with two local dads about Black fatherhood in that moment, a few months into the pandemic and less than a month after the murder of George Floyd. Today, exactly 1 year later, we welcome back Joel Christian Gill, a cartoonist, historian, and associate professor at Massachusetts College of Art and Design, and Charles Daniels, a therapist and CEO of Father's Uplift in Dorchester. Joel, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
And Charles, welcome back to you too.
Thank you.
So Joel, I'll start with you. How was your Father's Day?
Oh, Father's Day was great. All my kids came over. One of my daughters made me an old fashioned. It was amazing.
So remind us how many kids you have and how old they are.
I have four kids. I have twins that are 25. I have a middle daughter that's 21 and my son just turned 19.
So Charles, same to you. How was your Father's Day? And remind us about your kids.
It was pretty good. I had a great Father's Day, spent time with my family and headed to the beach as always when I'm away from the office. And my daughter is 9 months and my son is 6 years old. During our last interview, she wasn't born yet, but now she's here, so.
And how is she? You talked about that the last time we had you on.
Yeah, you know, she is doing pretty good at this particular juncture. She is just being a 9 month, bossing her brother around, eating, crawling, trying to walk, getting into things. But at this particular juncture, she's actually growing well and she's very healthy. We're proud to have her.
Did you two think that we'd be able to talk about a Father's Day like the one you just had a year ago? Or did you think we'd still be in sort of the dark days? Joel?
I actually think we're still in the dark days. To be completely honest with you, I think, you know, like we got Juneteenth now, but we don't really have much else, you know, and I mean, everybody pays attention, but, you know, I think America has a problem with racism and the way we talk about this, these, you know, the danger of Black bodies, kind of like an alcoholic has a problem with alcoholism. And what America has done over the last year is basically buy some books, some self-help books, and put them on the coffee table. And they're like, look, I'm reading these books now, but they still haven't stopped drinking. So that's kind of how
Charles,
I feel about it.
Charles, join in there.
Yeah, you know, for me, I think, you know, fundamentally, we as a nation have forgotten how to love one another. I think we have to really take it back one step further and teach people how to treat another human being despite their socioeconomic status, their race. I generally think we will remain in the dark days until we learn how to care for one another and embrace one another as if we are doing it to our loved ones. I think when we do that, we will leave this dark age. But I don't see that occurring anytime soon, but hopefully we can get closer.
So let's stay there. You know, when I asked the question about the dark days, I was thinking about the pandemic part of it. But when we spoke with you last year, it was less than a month after George Floyd was murdered. Now, you know, we anticipate Derek Chauvin, the former Minneapolis police officer convicted of that murder, to be sentenced on Friday. And yet I hear the two of you saying we are still in dark days. Did we not make progress you thought we would? Or we are just not making progress, and that's what you thought might be the case over those 12 months, Joel?
Well, I think, you know, as far as the pandemic's concerned, you know, yes. Like, I'm actually traveling right now, so, like, that's completely different than it was last year because I was, you know, homebound. But when you look at the Derek Chauvin case, you know, I say these really controversial things all the time. Derek Chauvin's defense was, this is what I was trained to do. And in reality, Derek Chauvin was right. He was trained to do that. And I believe that a lot of the people that came out, you know, a lot of the law enforcement people that came out to say that this was not about his treatment, realized that Derek Chauvin's actions was an indictment of the entire system, not just Derek Chauvin. And that's what we tend to do. We're going to make this one bad apple. This is just one bad apple personified, right? This is that idea that it's just one bad apple without actually really taking a look at the system. So yeah, Derek Chauvin got what he deserved, right? He should have gone to jail, but his defense was I was doing my job, and he's actually right.
Charles, Joel's kids are 25, 25, 21, and 19. I can imagine, and Joel, I will come back to you on this. I can imagine a conversation with kids that age about the things Joel just said. You've got a six-year-old. You know, we're talking about fatherhood here. How do you begin to think about having conversations with a six-year-old? Or how are you thinking in the future with that nine-month-old who's running circles around her brother as they start to come of age and awareness?
Yeah, you know, that's a great question. And I can say just from my vantage point that people of color have been in a pandemic prior to the actual pandemic. You know, to see Juneteenth finally become a federal recognized holiday now It's just an example as to how we think about living in America and struggling and trying to deal with the microaggression. So when I talk to my son about being a boy in America at this particular age, essentially I'm trying to protect him and really cultivate his imagination and who he is as a person. Nonetheless, I am preparing myself to have those conversations about what does it mean to be Black in America and to already be experiencing an internal pandemic and treat it as if you're in a pandemic, even when you are not physically dealing with something like COVID-19 or any other issue. I think it's imperative that our young men and boys learn that they're valued despite how they're treated when they leave their parents' house. So that's kind of my way of thinking and how I'm having these conversations with him is how can I make sure that he knows he's important despite what the world may tell him as he transitioned from being cute to a threat.
Joel, you've talked about this. You write about this. So talk about it more now with us.
Yeah, with my son, you know, he just graduated high school and, you know, he's like, I'm going to take a cross country trip. That's his big thing. And I'm like, I want that for him because that's something that I would have done at his age. But I'm also like, cut your hair as short as possible so you can be as white passing as you possibly can, because I fear for, you know, like I fear for him, you know, because teenage boys are teenage boys, right? And I, you know, it's one of those things where I just don't want him to be too comfortable. And it's not because I want him to be constantly afraid, but I want him to be appropriately afraid of things. I mean, my daughters have gotten to a place where they pretty much understand that. They're a little bit older. They've been out in the world a little bit longer. And so, you know, they get all of those things, you know, but my son, you know, he's young and he's a boy and he's a little naive. So I don't want him to, you know, I fear for him. And, you know, we have real conversations. He's like, you know, Dad, it's fine. I'll be fine. But, you know, I live in, you know, a secluded area in New Hampshire. You know, the police officers all know us and know our family. We, you know, the general store, everybody knows us. But it was when we leave this bubble, like that's when I'm afraid for it, because I don't know what's going to happen out there in the world. And, you know, we talk about this, you know, we've talked about this a lot. Like, yeah, we got Juneteenth and Derek Chauvin's going to jail, but we haven't done anything about, like, the system is broken. Right. And we've seen evidence, like last year was a stress test on the system. And, you know, and I think it was really slick for law enforcement officials, you know, from the you know, top down to say Derek Chauvin did this and he was one bad apple. But, you know, he was part of a system. He did what he was trained to do. And all you had to do in a broken system is your job. You know, like all you have to do is a broken system. Like Derek Chauvin going to jail is kind of like being mad at a McDonald's cashier for the taste of the hamburgers. They don't really do anything. They can't control it. So
Joel, I'm sure. I want to maintain our focus on fatherhood here. I'm sure
yes.
that there are listeners
who
would. No, it's okay. I say that to preface what I'm about to say now. I'm sure there are listeners who would want to engage in a conversation about police training and whether what Chauvin did was consistent with police training, et cetera. I just want to acknowledge that is a branch of conversation I'm choosing not to have because of the conversation that we are having. And in that, I want to ask the two of you, has anything changed? I don't even know if this is a silly question. I really don't, but I'm going to ask it. In the last year, has anything changed for either of you in what you think it means to be a father or a good father?
I think it's made me, I don't think anything has changed so much as it's made me more hyper-focused on these things. Like we get, you know, when these kind of things go away, we get lulled in this sense of security. So you kind of let you know, it's kind of like you don't think about it very much. And I constantly think about it. It's a fear that I have for my kids all the time. And, you know, and I think, I don't know if anything has changed for me other than it's just made me more hyper-focused and hyper-aware about the safety of my children and about what they're going to express, what they're going to experience in the world.
Charles, how about you? Or in your work with Fathers Uplift?
Yeah, I think for me, when it comes to changes, not many changes. However, I have become more hyper-vigilant. I also can tell you that there has been more awareness of my own mental health as well as the mental health of those that we currently serve. And I think right now for providers, therapists, doctors that are witnessing these issues themselves, dealing with them in their own household, world and is tasked with serving others and being fathers and parents to their own, it can be overwhelming. So I think for me specifically, really emphasizing the importance of self-care and interweaving it into my schedule, but at the end of the day, also making sure that my children, my six-year-old son, has a schedule where he feels as if he is detached from the world and his imagination can continue to take flight.
Is there anything for either of you that developed as part of this pandemic in your relationship with your kids or your practices as a family that you want to hold on to as we begin to emerge out of the pandemic?
Oh God, I mean, my kids are home all the time and that's one of those things where it's just like, it's a blessing and a curse. So, you know, they're always there, so I can always keep my eye on them, but also, everybody who's a parent knows this feeling, that feeling of being, you know, simultaneously afraid, but also wanting to let them be free. Like, how do you hold on, but also let go at the exact same time, which I think my wife and I both struggle with. Like, how do we hold on, but let go at the same time? So having them here, you know, like, that was the thing about the pandemic that I thought was really interesting for us, is because we could keep our children safe. Like, they didn't have to go anywhere. My daughter and son didn't have to work. They didn't have to do anything. And so, like, having them home and keeping them safe, but then also them bursting at the seams, wanting to get out and do things in the world, but we would just wanted to keep them safe. So it's like a, you know, the double-edged sword. It was great. Having them home all the time was great. And also terrible, but mostly great.
I think any parent, Joel, is nodding as they listen to you say that. Charles, how about you? Anything you want to keep? Oh, I wonder
Absolutely.
If we lost Charles.
You know,
oh, there he is.
I think when COVID-19 happened, you know, I've kind of seen a shift among my peers, but also myself, from, you know, business accolades to achieving and seeking to accomplish, to mainly focusing on family. And I know few people who've up and left to go be closer with their family, because I think how you look at life has changed once you see so many lives have been taken due to the pandemic, as well as, you know, racism in our country. So one thing that I would like to maintain, you know, when COVID happened, my wife and I and my son and my daughter, we would take these family drives and go to at least one new beach every weekend. And for us, we want to continue that, right? Really just turning off the computers, turn off the phones, and continue to do something different when we are together. Being around one another is the greatest, I would say, benefit that any dad can have, even when it becomes overwhelming. But sometimes when you are in the profession and too deep in the profession, you can end up losing sight of your family and what's most important. So those family drivings, as my son calls it, is something that we will continue to do and hold on to throughout this process.
Lightning round. Are you optimistic today, Joel?
I'm always optimistic. But, you know, I'm optimistic in a way that's sort of like, I gotta, you know, I'm not optimistic. Like, I gotta stop. I can not be vigilant anymore. And, you know, I spend all that time talking about policing and all this other stuff, because I believe that's the best way to protect my son. That's the best way to protect Charles's son, you know, is to make sure, you know, like, that's the thing that's going to relieve us as parents, is if we fix this system. And that would be great.
And we'll end it there. Joel Christian Gill, cartoonist, historian, and associate professor at Massachusetts College of Art and Design, and Charles Daniels, therapist and CEO of Father's Uplift in Dorchester. Two Mondays after Father's Day with the two of you. It's been a joy. Thanks.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
And listeners, that's our show. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Tiziana Deering. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.